Are you missing a page? I'll send it to you. We know that. Okay. Davchet Somud Beis. We'll start again. Davchet Somud Beis. The third line from the top. We're right in the middle of the subject of Shnayim Mikra Ve'Echod Targum. Oh, Shkoyach. Thank you. The Gemara told us that there is this din of going through each parsha twice along with the Targum. We began discussing the particulars, and now the Gemara is going to continue with some more particulars of this din. Rav Bibi Ba'abaye Sovar Lashleminu LeParshiyas DeKulei Shate. Rav Bibi Ba'abaye thought to do all the parshiyas of the entire year B'Ma'aliyoyim DeKippur, to do them all in one shot on Erev Yom Kippur. I guess that worked better for his schedule. What's that? I'm going to put that on hold meanwhile, because that depends on different understandings. But I guess it worked better for his schedule to just get it all over with in one shot. Erev Yom Kippur. Tana lechia barav midifti. So chia barav of difti quoted him a brisa that taught him a brisa that says ksiv, says in the pasuk that there are other things you're supposed to be busy with on Erev Yom Kippur. You're going to do all of Shnayim Mikra on Erev Yom Kippur. You're going to be very busy that day. You have very little time for anything else. We know that there's a very important activity on Erev Yom Kippur. Ksiv says in the pasuk, "V'nisem es nafsho yiseichem b'tisho lachodesh ba'erev." You should afflict yourselves on the ninth of the month in the evening. Now that implies the evening of the ninth. Is that when Yom Kippur is? Yom Kippur is the evening of the tenth. V'chibetisho mis'anin. Do you afflict yourself on the ninth? V'aloi ba'asora mis'anin. We afflict ourselves on the tenth. What? Two days in a row. How do we know that Hashem didn't want us to do it 2 days in a row? But the pasuk afterwards explicitly says that the fast is the tenth. This is the pasuk leading up to it. On the evening of the ninth.
Beginning of the ninth.
Maybe it's 2 days in a row. Maybe it's 2 days in a row. I hear. Maybe it's from the fact that the Torah at the end of the day does relate to this day in the singular term. The Torah does call it Yom HaKippurim. A day. It doesn't call it the days of Kippur, of atonement. The day of atonement. Maybe. I didn't think of the question. It's an interesting question. I didn't see it addressed either. Why is the Gemara why is it automatically assumed that it doesn't mean 2 days? I don't know. But maybe that's the pshat. But Shana also is really one day. We just do 2 days because of technicalities. Oh, that's true. That's right. That's the answer. The pasuk actually ultimately, subsequently says explicitly, you fast from evening to evening, which is 24 hours. That's true. Right. No, because that's explicit in the pasuk. The Torah is much clearer about that in the subsequent psukim, that the day of Yom Kippur is the 10th day. Just that the pasuk leading up to it, the preamble, terms it this way. It was one time in history where they fasted 2 days of Yom Kippur. Not so long ago in Shanghai. That's right. And they had a suffix. Right, not everybody did. But they weren't sure which was a big machloikis poiskim, whether Japan is, which side of the dateline Japan is on. There's some big machloikis. Many followed one opinion or the other, but there were some who fasted both days. But that's certainly not the chiyuv. Whatever the case is, do we fast on the 10th? On the 9th? Baloi ba'asora mis'anin. We fast on the 10th. El aloi maloch. Rather, the point of the pasuk is, anybody who eats and drinks on the ninth, on Erev Yom Kippur, Ma'ale Olav HaKosel, the Torah considers it as though Kilomis Anet Chivasir, as if you fasted on the ninth and tenth day, meaning the Torah is actually implying that there's a special mitzvah to eat on the ninth of Tishrei, on Erev Yom Kippur. And it's expressed, why is it expressed as fasting? Because the Torah is telling you, you get the schus of fasting by eating on the ninth. Whatever it is, what's the point that he's making too, Rav Bibi? He's meant to be eating. You can't occupy yourself with Shai Mikra, that's going to occupy basically all day. So, therefore he dropped that plan. Okay. Sovala Akdomino. So he, therefore he thought, instead of waiting with Shnai Mikra for Erev Yom Kippur, he'll do it in advance. I guess it just didn't work for him to fit it into the regular weekly schedule. So he wanted to do it in advance. Maybe he would sit down in the Chol HaMoed Sukkos and go through the whole thing and cover himself for the year. So elder taught him, Tanina. No, a Braisa says, O bilvad shelo yakdim v'shelo ya'achem. No, you can't do it too early and you can't do it too late. You have to do it when the tzibur does that parsha. Kido omalu Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi libane. It's like Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi taught his children. He told them, Ashlimu parshia seichu im ha'tzibur shnei mikra ve'achotagum. You have to do your parshias with the tzibur. That's the stressor. You have to do it with the tzibur. Shnai mikra ve'chotago. Not beforehand and not afterwards. So therefore, this is the conclusion of this sugya. The Gemara is going to continue with another couple of directives that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi instructed his children. But this is the conclusion of this sugya. Shnai mikra ve'chotago should be done with the tzibur. Not earlier and not later. Okay, so here we move into the next obvious question. How exactly do you define that? What does im hatzibur mean? So, there were rishonim that cite a minig that used to be an earlier keilus that is mamish done with tzibur. They used to sit down, tumin hagim avor on this. Before Kriyas HaTorah, after Kriyas HaTorah, the whole tzibur would sit down together and they would do shnayim mikra all together. That was part of the process. But lamaisa, that's not the consensus. What is the consensus? What is the halacha on this? What is the time frame for Shnayim Mikra? You obviously, as we discussed, you're not doing it during Kriyas HaTorah. So what does it mean to do it with the tzibur? So let's see Tosfos on this. We'll see a Tosfos together. The second to last Tosfos on the page. Yashlim, okay? Yashlim Parshi Yosef. Okay? What's that? Can you do Shnai Mikra during Kriyas HaTorah?
One of the Kriyas.
Oh. Okay. So, okay, I just asserted that you can't do Shnai Mikra during Kriyas HaTorah. So the truth is, Rav Shlomo is asking, can you not? So I can interpret Rav Shlomo's question in two ways. First of all, maybe you're allowed to do Shnai Mikra during Kriyas HaTorah. The truth is that many Paiskim say, the Rishonim, general, the basic consensus of the Rishonim is, that even though we discuss that you're not supposed to be engaged in any form of learning even during Kriyas HaTorah, Shnai Mikra is the exception to the rule. That's what you're hearing? That's what we're doing? And actually the Shulchan Aruch rules that. You're allowed to do Shnai Mikra during Kriyas HaTorah. But yet, the Achrayim, Lemaisa, don't say that should not be practiced La'alocha, the Vilna Goyin and others. That should not be practiced La'alocha. You shouldn't do anything other than what the tzibur is doing. However, there's a different question that could be asked. Can you actually consider the Kriyas HaTorah as one of the two times of going through the mikra? So that lamaisa the Mishavura paskins on that if you're actually reading along with the Baal Torah, which you're encouraged to do, Kriyas HaTorah, you're encouraged to read along quietly with him because it's hard to keep focus otherwise. If you're actually reading along with him, you can count it towards one of the two Hebrew readings. Otherwise not. If you're just hearing it, lechatchila, you shouldn't count it, though you could. You could, but lechatchila, it's best to actually say it yourself. So if you're reading along with the Baal Torah, you can count it. If not, better not. better not to.
Which means what?
Now, what is, so what is the time frame for Shnayim Mikra? We said it has to be with the tzibur. What exactly does that mean? So let's see this Tosis. Yashlim. Okay, the second to last Tosis on the page. Yashlim parshiyos avim atzibur. You should complete your parshiyos with the tzibur. Nira, Tosis says that it seems Nikol Shavua. How do we define with the tzibur? So Tosis is going to tell us that with the tzibur means during the time frame that the tzibur is reading this parsha. When does the tzibur begin reading the parsha Shavua? Mincha of Shabbos, right? The mincha before that week's parsha. So the kol haShavua mikivam matzchilin likos haParsha. The entire week from when you first begin reading that parsha. Dahainu mimimchas Shabbos ve'ilach, meaning from mincha on Shabbos ad Shabbos haba, until the next Shabbos when they actually read that for the Kriyas HaTorah, nikres imat tzibur. That's called reading it with the tzibur. This is Tosis. That's Tosis is saying very logical. That's the time frame that the tzibur is reading it in, and therefore you basically have a week for Shnayim Mikra from mincha on Shabbos until next Shabbos when it's read b'tzibur. Now, v'afagavdele inyan gitin lo nikre kamesh Shabbos. Now, Tosis precludes an interesting possibility. Some Rishonim actually say this. You must read Shnayim Mikra no earlier than Wednesday. Why? Because in other areas of halacha, if somebody says they're going to do something before Shabbos, how do you define before Shabbos? From Wednesday is called before Shabbos for halachic purposes. So, for example, when it comes to a get, what implications does a get have on before Shabbos? There's such a concept of a husband declaring, "I'm giving my wife a get." This was common in earlier times. A husband would go on a faraway journey. He wasn't sure if he would return. That's how it was in earlier times. He weren't sure if he would return from a faraway journey, and therefore they would often give a get. In case I'm not back by X by this time, you're divorced. So what happens if you would say, in case I'm not back by Shabbos Parshas Mishalach, before Shabbos? What does before Shabbos mean? It means before Wednesday. That's before Shabbos. From Wednesday and on is considered before Shabbos. So therefore, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday is called after the previous Shabbos. Wednesday, that's right. You can make Abdullah till Tuesday. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday is considered before Shabbos. So therefore,
after Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday.
Sorry. The case then gets the other way around. He says, if I'm not back by after Shabbos, it means he has to be back by Tuesday.
Tuesday after partial.
Yeah. So therefore, you might say that here also Shnayim Mikra shouldn't be done earlier than Wednesday. Some Rishonim do say this. Shnayim Mikra should not be done earlier than Wednesday because that's still part of the previous parsha. It's only from Wednesday is considered part of this week's parsha. So Tosis says no. That's not the case here, because here the issue is you're supposed to be reading Shnayim Mikra when the Tzibur is reading this parsha. When is the Tzibur reading this parsha? From Mincha and Shabbos until the next Shabbos. So you have the whole week. You can begin Shnayim Mikra from after Mincha, the previous Shabbos. Now, Uzman HaShlomo Yesh BeMedrash. Now, when is the deadline for Shnayim Mikra? So Medrash tells us, Gimel Dvorin Tziva Rabbeinu HaKadosh. Rabbeinu HaKadosh commanded three things, Lebanav, to his children, Bishar Shenifta, when he was dying. He issued three directives to his children. One of his directives was, do not sit down for the Suda on Shabbos, don't wash for the Suda, before you complete Shnayim Mikra. In the morning. So therefore we see Rebbe is saying that the deadline is the Suda Shabbos morning. Mashma de koidem achila tzorich lashlima. Now this implies that it should be completed before the Suda. So you have from Mincha, the previous Shabbos, until the Suda of that Shabbos. Now, I'll just note that, well, let's see. Let's let Tosis continue. Umiu im ishlim ala acha achilo shap yadoni. However, the truth is that putting the deadline at the Suda doesn't really make sense, because you should either say, you're saying that we go the whole period that the Tzibor is reading this parsha, that either ends at Kriyas HaTorah this Shabbos, right? Or you might argue that no, it doesn't end at Kriyas HaTorah. Until they start the new parsha, it's still called this week's parsha, which will mean Mincha. So it should, that deadline should either be Kriyas HaTorah of Shacharis or Mincha when they start next week's parsha. Why the Suda? The Suda is, and they say, Nishtahin, Nishtaher. The Tzibur doesn't finish reading it at the Suda. So therefore, Taisa says, no. Really, it's acceptable to do Shnai Mikra until the Tzibur starts next week's Parsha, which means until Mincha. Rebbe is just saying that it's a mitzvah min amuvcha. It's better to do it before eating the Suda. Why? It's really just the technicality, but you see that Rebbe was very into it. That was what he found it important to tell his children before he died. But the Bialach explains that the reason is simply because, you can probably all figure out from experience, after the challenge, you know, between the challenge and Mincha, you're likely not to do it. So therefore, do it before the Suda. So essentially, the Zman of Shnai Mikra, this is Lahalocha, the time of Shnai Mikra is from Mincha and Shabbos to Mincha and Shabbos. Mitzvah min Amuvchar is to complete it before the Suda on Shabbos. And as we've seen the other day, that the Mikubalim make a big deal about making it a Friday activity, meaning either to complete it on Friday, not that you have to do the whole thing on Friday. The Arizal actually did the whole thing on Friday. But the Arizal would sit down Friday morning, Talis and Tefillin, open up a Sefer Torah, and he would do Shnai Mikra, the entire parish on Friday from the Sefer Torah. How would he do the Targum? He had a Talmud. This you could do if you're the Arizal, or if you have a lot of devoted Talmidim. He had a Talmud sitting next to him. As he read each pasuk from the Torah, the Talmud would read the Targum, and he would recite it after the Talmud. That was how the Arizal did it. Well, we could do it with a tape recorder, I guess. What's the Targum is Torah Shabbat?
That's preferable to reading?
What's that? For the Targum. For the Targum. Not for the Mikra itself.
For the Targum, it's preferable to not read it, but to...
No. Preferable not. Preferable not. Just he wanted to read it from the Torah. In the Torah, you don't have the Targum. Yeah. He would repeat it after the Talmud. Yeah, he was reading from the Sefer Torah. Right, so that was all. The Gaon, so the Mishnah Berurah says it's not a conflict. The Vilna Gaon we cited the other time, last time, and he would actually sit down every day of the week, he would do a little bit. He would complete it on Friday. That's what the Mishnah Berurah says, that the idea of doing it on Friday doesn't mean you have to do the whole parsha on Friday. It means, don't finish it before Friday. Finish it on Friday. So that's why the Vilna Gaon would time it, he would do a little bit each day of the week, he'd complete it on Friday. We'll get to that. Not necessarily in Aliyah. He would do a little bit each day of the week, he would finish it on Friday. The Arizal did the whole thing on Friday. But the main point is, be busy with it on Friday. Don't finish it all before Friday. The next question is, this is a question you asked last time. Shlomo is asking a question now. How do you divide it up? Well, what's the best way to go about doing Shnai Mikra? Do you go by the Aliyah? Do you go by the Perek? Pasuk by Pasuk? So really, there are two fundamental approaches. The Arizal held of doing it pasuk by pasuk. You read each pasuk twice with the Targum. The Vilna Gaon and the Shlah held that you do it parsha by parsha. Not Perek and not Aliyah. Perek, by the way, it's just important to know. The Perekim are not authoritative. They are actually of Christian origin. The division of the Perekim. Not that there's anything... nothing necessarily negative about it, it's just important to note there's nothing positive about it. It's a convenient way of referencing. That's what the Perekim are. There's something somewhat negative about it in the sense that it's sometimes misleading, because you think that a subject ends where the Perek ends, while it really doesn't necessarily. Really, the only authoritative division of the Torah is the Parshias, which is the Peis and the Samachs, right? And in the Chumash you have the Peis and the Samach. Those are the only authoritative way of dividing up subjects in the Torah. And that's, according to the Gaon, that's the way you do Shnai Mikra. Parsha by parsha. Meaning from one Peos Samach till the next Peos Samach.
anything wrong with just doing one reading
of the entire parsha
and then doing another reading of the entire parsha, just doing a whole reading of the time?
Yes, but, I mean, wrong. I don't know. I wouldn't call it wrong. It's not the preferred way. Christ can say that the best way is to do it more piece by piece, which either means pasuk by pasuk or parsha by parsha. Now,
certainly acceptable, because if you're being yotzei with the reading on Shabbos morning and you're reading along with it, that's one straight
reading of the entire parsha. Right. That's why I said I wouldn't call it wrong, but it's not the preferred way. The preferred way is either pasuk by pasuk or parsha by parsha. What's behind it? I would imagine Kabbalah, because it's a machlokes of the Mekubalim. L'maisa, the Mishnah Berurah says either way is fine. So once it's the Mekubalim debating, it's over our heads. Out of stump, practically, I find that it's if you're really trying to learn it, it works better to do parsha by parsha, because then you know you see the whole subject together and you see the perush. You get that's practical. It's, you know, do what works for you. But I say either way is fine. I just note another thing that the Vilna Gaon also says, like sometimes, for example, you like to do it day by day. What do you do with a parsha like Miketz, for example? Miketz is basically, the whole parsha is basically one parsha. There aren't Peis and Samachs in the middle. No Psuchas and Stumas. How are you going to break it up? So the Vilna Gaon says parsha by parsha or inyan by inyan. Meaning, if you can, in a sensible way, divide it up by inyan, and that's also okay, even if it's not an official stopping point of the parsha. So, you can do that too. And also, Reb Chaim Kanievsky said, Lamaisa, you want to do it aliyah by aliyah, because that just makes it easier to keep track of. That's acceptable too. Meaning, any way really is acceptable. Just, these are the preferred ways of doing it if all factors are equal. Okay. We'll move on. So now we completed the subject of the Shnai Mikra. We're going to continue. Once we started the list of the things that Rabbi Yishua ben Levi instructed his children, we're going to continue with a couple more. Vizaru bivridin k'Rabbi Yehuda. He instructed them to adhere to a certain chumrah in Shechita. Make sure to shecht both veins in accordance with the Shita of Rabbi Yehuda. That means as follows. Shechita essentially involves two arteries, or not arteries, the esophagus and the trachea, right, the two main pipes, the food pipe and the wind pipe. Now, besides that, there are two veins in the animal's throat that are not really an essential part of the Shechita. The main part of the Shechita is to make sure you get the two simanim, what we call it, right? But yet Rabbi Yehuda was machmir to make sure that you cut both veins as well, just because that helps with the process of getting rid of all the blood. It's very hard to get rid of the blood otherwise. Those veins are what helps expel much of the blood out of the body. When you actually do it by Shechita, it's facilitated by the still working body, which actually pumps the blood out. Afterwards, it's much more complicated, much more difficult to properly extract the blood. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda said, Rabbi Yehuda's shita was, you have to make sure you get both veins. V'tnan, it says in the Mishnah, Rabbi Yehuda Oimer, ad sheyishchot es havridin. You have to make sure to shecht both veins. So he told them to be machmir on this as well. By the way, it's interesting. We very much rely on that point of the body that was just slaughtered helping, the muscles that are still working helping to pump out the blood. That's why, for example, among the different humanitarian suggestions was to, nobody likes the sight of the animal jumping around after it's shechted. Okay? It's a very politically incorrect sight. Therefore, one of the things that they tried to, I don't know if it was actually passed as a law in some place or not, was that even if we're not going to ban Shechita, the animal should be shot in the head immediately after Shechita. Now, why would the Paiskim oppose that? And the answer is because of this issue. When the animal is slaughtered at the neck, the body continues to work, and the blood is pumped out. see the blood comes still shooting out with force for a while afterwards. When they shoot the animal in the head right a second after Shechita, it paralyzes the systems, the blood stops flowing. The animal drops, stops moving, the blood stops flowing. And that once again complicates things with extraction of the blood afterwards. I'm not talking halacha l'maaseh here, I'm just mentioning a point of interest that's been raised. Okay. What's that? Oh, the truth is that this halacha being makbir on cutting the veins was really only said about birds. Because about birds which were generally roasted whole. When you're talking about an animal that is cut into pieces, extracting the blood is anyways easier, even if you aren't helped by these veins. Directive number 3. Bizaru bezoken sheshochach talmudoi machmasoinsa. You must be very careful about the honor, to preserve the honor of a chacham who forgot his learning through no fault of his own. Meaning, either because he grew older and his memory failed him, or, Rashi says even, the pressures of life caught up with him. He's not able to be as involved in learning as he was. And therefore, he simply forgot a lot of his learning because he's been busy with all kinds of other things. Well, Lamais, it's not that he sat down and decided he's going to take it easy. You have to be very careful with such a person. Daminon. Because we know the famous principle. Luchois v'shimkur luchois munachois ba'oran. You know that the original luchos were broken, right? So, yet Moshe Rabbeinu was told to put the original broken luchos into the arayin together with the new luchos. So you see that the reverence of the broken luchos was kept, was maintained. Thank you. Well, we're not talking about the level of derech eretz you have to have for every person. But the question is, do all the special chiyuvim of revering a Talmud Chacham apply to a person who no longer has the information? Who can no longer, right now, he can't meet the qualifications of a Talmud Chacham? Does he still warrant that special respect? And the answer is yes. The truth is, I mean, this is really an issue of really understanding what Torah does to a person. We learn Torah, it's absorbed in our minds. But the truth is that what we're doing with Torah is shaping our neshama. Now, the mind really is the bottommost and most physical level of the neshama. We're told that the neshama is in the moyach, in the brain. That's where the neshama is. But the truth is that even that, it's not really the actual neshama. It's something other than neshama. The neshama itself is above what we can access as long as we're in our body. You can't really access your neshama. You can access your mind, which is a certain physical representation of the neshama. You can't really access your neshama. Now, when you learn Torah, the first place you deposit it is in your mind. And a major, major function of Torah is to shape your mind. That's really the ultimate function of Torah. You are your mind. Your mind is your personality. Main point of Torah is to change who you are, not just what you do. That's why Torah is the greatest of mitzvahs. Because Torah develops in you the Torah personality. It's not just an action, isolated action that you do. It shapes your mind.
I am my mind. My mind is not really part of my neshama. Why should I care about my neshama? It's not me.
Your mind, as the you're your neshama. The closest thing you have to your neshama is your mind, because the mind, if we'll put it into a little bit more Reb Chaim Volozhiner terms, there's nefesh, ruach, and neshama. Right? Man is composed of nefesh, ruach, and neshama. Those are the three spiritual components, that's the word, of each person. The nefesh, ruach, and neshama each have their nefesh, ruach, and neshama. Now, when we talk about the neshama that we can access, the neshama in our mind, it's talking about the neshama of the ruach. It's a little complicated, but it's the neshama of the ruach. The actual neshama is really above us, but the neshama of the ruach is what connects with the nefesh of the neshama. Okay, you following me? Put it this way. There's three levels. Each level has three levels. The highest level that we know of is level number one of level number two. The actual neshama is above us. But that's the connection. What's that? Chaya Nichida beyond anything we can relate to. But the neshama that we talk about as being in us, that we relate to in our lifetime, is the neshama shebaruach. That's in our mind. And that is what connects to the actual neshama. So, you are, when we're talking about which part of you that you're conscious of today is really you, it's your mind. But the truth is, that's the bottommost level. That's the most physical level. What's even more you is the neshama that you're completely not conscious of in your lifetime. Now, by learning Torah, you're impacting your mind, but on a deeper level, you're impacting your neshama. You're shaping your neshama by learning Torah, but that you have no access to. That's we always use the mashal. I'm sure everybody already heard me say this. I say it at least once in 2 weeks. And in this world, we're like a person who's completely under anesthesia except for his little toe. That's all of your experience in this world is basically your little toe. You're not experiencing yourself, the rest of your body at all. Right, that's all above you. As soon as a person is nifter, he suddenly becomes exposed to himself. He suddenly begins experiencing himself. So you can be going through this life doing all kinds of mitzvahs and things. You have no idea what you're doing to yourself. It suddenly hits you when the anesthesia wears off. So that's why really what Torah is doing, yes, the Torah is in your mind, but what it's really doing is shaping your neshama. Now let's say the mind stops working and the person is still alive. So the bottommost level of what his Torah is now not working anymore. But the main effects of his Torah, which are on the neshama, are still as strong as ever. Therefore, it's obvious that a Talmud Chacham doesn't lose his respect, doesn't lose his rights as a Talmud Chacham once he forgets his Torah. Unless it's a fault of his own. If it's his own fault, as the Gemara says, "B'yoshev v'mishakeach," meaning, if he doesn't take care to retain his Torah, then he's actually draining his neshama. If Talmud Chacham decides, okay, I learned enough Torah, now I can engage in comic books, so each comic book that he reads instead of a Daf Gemara drains the neshama a little more. So by the time he replaced all his Torah with comics, there's nothing left to respect. Well, when a person doesn't drain his neshama, it's not through his fault, all of the Torah that he learned is still engraved in his neshama. That person is still a Talmud Chacham, even though there's none of it left in his mind. And therefore, it's a given. It's obvious. It's sure. All of the respect is still fully due him.
Okay, and why usually we say that the physical is a reflection of what's going on in a higher level. So if he lost it, why is it necessary that to say that it doesn't reflect what's going on?
The physical is not necessarily a reflection of the higher level. Not necessarily. Why should that be a rule?
Usually things don't just exist in a vacuum. They relate from,
well, they relate, but no, if a Talmud Chacham has a broken leg, that doesn't necessarily mean that those aspects of his neshama are in trouble. If a person forgot his Torah through his own fault, then yes, that will reflect. Our maisim reflect our neshama, but what our physical body looks like doesn't reflect our neshama. So that's on the little more esoteric level. On the, if you want, on a more practical level, a Talmud Chacham will learn Torah. Lamaisa, Torah also shapes a person's personality. That's going to remain even if after he forgets his Torah. Meaning, if he became a refined person as a result of his learning, as a result of his whole lifetime of Avodah, that's not going to change when he loses his Torah. He doesn't suddenly turn into a coarse, gruff, bad, ill-mannered person. He's going to stay the same personality that the Torah turned him into. So therefore, yes, a Zakeh who forgot his Torah still has the full rights, if we'll call it that, is still due the full respect of a full-fledged Talmud Chacham. Now, Omar Aluhu, by the way, I'll just note in that context, the Sfarna says that's a Tzelem Elikim. Tzelem Elikim is a person's mind. What a person makes out of his mind, meaning personality, I should say, the person's psyche. What a person makes out of his mind is what's going to continue after death. That's who he is. That's a Tzelem Elikim of a person. That's what continues after he dies. A person's consciousness, a person's personality. Your personality is what you know, what you like, what you don't like, all of your sentiments. This is what you're supposed to be busy developing throughout your life, because that's how you're going to be afterwards. And that, again, that's most readily manifest in your mind, but actually it's impacting the neshama that's above that. Okay, so those were the three directives that Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi gave his sons. Interesting to note, what were the three things that he found it so urgent to convey to them as he was dying? Make sure to finish Shnayim Mikra before the Suda, because he might be too tired afterwards. If we would just see this halacha, that it's a good idea to finish Shnayim Mikra before the Suda because he might be too tired afterwards, I'm saying it's a shtickle technicality. But Rebbe considered it so chashuv that that's what he was telling them on his deathbed. Give us a little bit more of an appreciation for the little technical suggestions that the place can make. Okay. Now, we also list a list of directives that Rava gave his children. When you cut meat, don't cut it over your hand. Meaning, don't hold the piece of meat in your hand and cut with the knife. Right? Isn't this what every mother tells her child and husband, right? Now, why? Some say because it's dangerous. You might slice your hand. Others say because it might ruin the meal. Meaning, even if you're not going to mamish injure yourself in a serious way, if you make a little bit of a nick in your hand and there's a little bit of blood, even if it's not going to actually prohibit the meat, it'll already be disgusting. The truth is actually... holding a piece of meat and cutting it. Cutting it while he's holding it in his hand, such that he might cut his hand in the process.
It's specifically meat.
What's that?
As opposed to like an apple. I mean, this is specific
to
meat.
I guess this is just the most common example of something you have to cut in order to eat.
It's hard, you have to cut it off.
Right.
Apples
easy
to do
with that. That's true. Directive number two is do not sit on a non-Jewish woman's bed. What's this referring to? We'll see soon.
Well,
this isn't Rav saying on his death, but this was just general directives he would give to his children. And we'll see soon what the significance of them is.
Don't sit.
We'll see soon what that means. And do not pass behind the shul while the tzibur is davening. Now we'll elaborate. Al teishva al mitas aramis. Do not sit on a non-Jewish woman's bed. Ike da'amri. So some explain this to be a more figurative way of saying something else. Lo tignu beloy kriyashma. Don't go to sleep without kriyashma al amita. Going to sleep without Kriyat Shema Le'emita is like sleeping on a non-Jewish woman's bed. It's a strong statement. But the Ben Ish Chai says, Ben Yehuda says, that when a person goes to sleep without Kriyat Shema, we learned about these things earlier. When a person goes to sleep without Kriyat Shema, there's all kinds of different forces of Tumah. And yes, he should realize that he's lying amongst a whole bunch of all kinds of unpleasant personalities. One of the names brought in by the Paiskim in this context is someone by the name of Lelis, a woman, a demoness, however you call them, a woman demon. So yeah, you should realize that going to sleep without Kriyat Shema is like lying with all kinds of non-Jewish women or worse.
So girls and women also.
What's that?
Women and girls also have the same.
They might not have the element of the protection from sin, etc., but from the different forces of Tumah, they do. Yeah. It's an issue of protection. The Ikeda Amri, another explanation is, and this one is surprising, the Leitintzevu Giyorta, do not marry a Giyoris. We'll get back to this momentarily, but let's first see the third explanation. Ve'ike da'amri, and a third explanation is haramis mamish, means literally, don't sit on a non-Jewish woman's bed. This means, even if you have business dealings and you have to enter a non-Jew's home for whatever reason, don't sit down on the bed. Why? Because of an incident that happened with Rav Papa. Rav Papa oza legabei aramis. Rav Papa once went into a non-Jewish woman's home, and the Gemara elsewhere gives a fuller story. She owed him money, and he used to come by every day, knocked on the door to ask for his debt, and every day she pushed him off, and finally she told him, okay, I'm going to pay you, come in and sit down. He came in. She took out a bed, and she told him, here, have a seat. He told her, Papa was suspicious. He knew that she wasn't very interested in helping him out. He was always trying to dodge the debt. So he told her, I'm not going to sit down until you show me what's underneath. She picked up the bed, and there was a dead child underneath. Her idea was to have him sit down and then claim that he had killed the child. And the Gemara elsewhere actually tells this story a little differently. It says that she did accuse him of killing the child, and he got in trouble. So Mikan Amu Chachamim, based on this, the Chachamim said, Asu Leishev Al Mita Saramis. You're not allowed to sit down on a non-Jewish woman's bed.
He learned from the other story to be careful this time.
Oh, very good. So the Mefarshim Taka get into what exactly happened. Did he catch it on time? Did he not catch it on time? So some suggest, like you just said, there were actually two separate stories. After he had his first experience, where he did sit down and he got in trouble, they I don't know, it's not clear in the Gemara what ended up happening. But he learned the lesson the next time. But the truth is that we should understand, but Rishonim point this out. Oh, so this means, oh, we figured out, they're going to have this one trick. They stick dead kids under beds. And that's what you have to beware of when you're dealing with goyim. They have this knack for inserting kids under beds. So don't sit on their beds. So the Rishonim say, obviously, the point here is to convey a broader message. Be very suspicious. And be on guard in all directions. Whenever there's any friendly offer made, try to figure out what's behind it. Don't let yourself be caught, pulled into something like this.
I'm surprised they don't say don't isolate yourself.
What's that?
I'm surprised they don't say don't isolate yourself.
So the truth is, not to isolate yourself is, in any case, understood. You're not allowed to anyways. Here, I'm imagining that the pshat here is that he wasn't isolated with her. That there were other people present. Her husband might have been there. And, on the contrary, they were plotting this together. What's that? Yeah, that would be a good idea. Right, come along with a few guys. In any case, it's a good idea. But? Yeah. Okay. Now, let's just back up to Loitinsuvu Giyoto. What does that mean? Don't marry a Giyoris. So, this is at first glance, it's surprising. I have a mitzvah about Haftos Agir. So the truth is that there's just a sober point being brought across here, that at the end of the day, yes, but you do have to be suspicious that influences from the previous life will remain. You can't stick your head into the sand. If you want to marry a Gieris, you have to be very, very careful that Lamaisa, you're not going to be running into all kinds of things that are residue that are still left from her previous life. You must be careful. Now, the Yavitz, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, says that this refers more specifically to a woman who had already been married as a Goya, or already had experience as a Goya, because as when she had been a Goya, because it's, we already know that from other sources that cohabitation with an Orel, with a non-circumcised person, feels different for the man, for the woman, and therefore she might have different expectations, different standards. She might not be satisfied with the Jewish way it's going to work. She also might not be satisfied with the Jewish way of life, which includes abstinence every so often for a certain amount of time. She might not be able to handle that. She might not be accustomed to that. You might be running yourself into problems. And therefore, Rabbi Yaakov Emden says that it's likely that this Gemara refers only to women who have actually had experience. And he actually points out other Gemaras that says that actually Giyoros were considered a popular commodity. He says apparently it depends whether this is a woman who was actually married before or not. But the Gaon does say that this is a general, just an alert. Be careful. When you're marrying a Giyoros, be careful, because she's coming with baggage. You have to make sure that you're not running yourself into problems.
Popular women.
What's that? They were a popular shidduch. What? When? In the Gemara times. It's a Gemara. Giyoros were popular. They were sought after shidduch for whatever reason.
Oh, they were
thought after. Yeah. The truth is, yeah, I would imagine that it's really an issue of each case with its particulars. It was a Talmud of Reb Shlomo Zalman who was offered a shidduch with a Giyoros, and he asked Reb Shlomo Zalman. Reb Shlomo Zalman said, this is an opportunity. It can be mekayim 24 hours a day, the mitzvah of ahavta mitzager, the mitzvah to love a ger. So obviously it depends on the particulars of the case. Who? Well, I don't know who you're referring to, but you can come on to greater sages than who you're talking. Whoever it is you're talking about, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Amram Bloy. He married a Giyoros. That's right. But Rabbi Akiva married a Giyoros. Yeshua married a Giyoros. That's right. So the Mefarshim point this out again. First of all, it's saying that it obviously depends on the case. And some say, okay, they were acting al pi ruach hakodesh, but others say that no, on the contrary, you see from those cases that it depends on the individual. The point is that you have to be careful. Okay. They're suggesting to beware. To beware. Okay.
The rabbi was a coin, and that's why he didn't want his son to marry.
Well, that's all discussion. It's a kasha that the Mefarshim ask. Rabbi was a kohen. Why did he have to tell his children this, anyways? Because kohanim are not allowed to marry giyoros. Therefore, some infer it's a whole shaila. Who does it say he was a kohen? Rabbi or Rabbi? Some infer from this gemara that Rabbi wasn't the kohen. It was Rabbi who was a kohen. It's not clear. It's a gemara that says that Abaya and Reishim Vase, either Aleph or Hey, either Rabbi or Rabbi, came from Eli. And there's different inferences whether it was actually Rava or Rabba. This is one of the proofs that it wasn't Rava, it was Rabba. Because if Rava was a Kohen, he wouldn't have had to instruct his children not to marry Giyoros. Okay. Al tavra achor besakneses b'shoa shatzibur mispalvi. The last directive was, do not pass behind the shul when the tzibur is davening. What's the idea here? So, misayah leilu Rabbi Yishua ben Levi. This supports Rabbi Yishua ben Levi. Damar Rabbi Yishua ben Levi. Yishua ben Levi said, "Asu loy leAdam sheyavor achorei beis hakneses b'shoa shatzibur mispalel. You're not allowed to pass behind the shul when the tzibur is davening. Why? The point here is that the tzibur is davening. You're walking by the shul. You're showing that you're not interested in joining the tzibur for davening. What's that?"
Daven.
Why don't you daven with the tzibur?
You davened already earlier. You davened at the 7 o'clock. Now it's the 8 o'clock.
Oh, so let's see the Gemara. So Omar. So therefore, the Gemara draws a few qualifications, including what you just mentioned. So the point here is that yes, when you walk by a shul and the tzibur is davening, it looks like you're not interested in davening. So Omar Abaye. So Abaye draws. We draw five qualifications. Le'amon el deleke pischa achrina. This is only if there's no other entrance to the shul. Aval ike pischa achrina leislam ba. If there is a different entrance, there's no problem because maybe you're going around to the other side. Veloyamaran ela deleke beknishta achrina. Here's your point. This only applies if there's no other shul in town. Aval ike beknishta achrina leislam ba. If there's a different shul in town, then there's no room for suspicion. He davened at the other minyan. So we're talking about a case where this is the only minyan in town, and there is room for suspicion. Now, even if it's the only shul in town, still, if people will realize that you're not just ignoring it, but you're busy with something, it's not a problem. And therefore, the problem is only if you're strolling by with your hands behind your back whistling. Well, not quite. But the problem is only if you are clearly not occupied. La'amon elo deloidori tuna. The problem is only if you're not carrying a package, or you're not rushing, or you're not wearing tefillin. If you are doing one of these things, it's not a problem. Meaning, if the tzibur sees that you're clearly busy with something, that's why you didn't daven now, you have to daven early, you'll have to daven later, that's okay. Also, if you're wearing tefillin, then they're not going to suspect that you don't care about davening. You're showing that you're a frum person. And therefore, that also wouldn't be a problem. Okay? We'll stop here.